Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to EAN Cast, weekly neurology. My name is Marian Galovic. I'm a neurologist based in Zurich, Switzerland. And my guest today is Federico Semeraro, professor of anesthesia and intensive care in Bologna in Italy, and also the chair of the European Resuscitation Council. Thank you, Federico, for joining us today. And today we're diving into the intersection between cardiac arrest and neurology, focusing on how AI is reshaping every second of cardiac arrest care, and how AI helps turning data into decisive action when lives hang in the balance. So to kick things off, Federico, could you tell our listeners a bit about yourself and what sparked your passion for both resuscitation science and artificial intelligence?
So thank you very much for the kind invitation. Yes, I was always very fascinated by technology. So some years ago, I jumped in the world of AI because I was always considering my in my world like a geek. So in the middle between medicine and expert or madman expert in technology. So obviously, as you know, machine learning is very comes from a long galaxy far away because machine learning was founded in 1956. And recently, the large language model arrived to us like a super hot topic. Everybody wants to talk about AI. In reality, it is not really AI, but it's like a matryoshka, a deep learning, large language model. So I was fascinated at that time how AI and all the tools from ChatGPT to Gemini to the others can help our work like a part of the team. This was I fall in love for cardiac arrest 25 ago, and now I fall in love, not completely fall in love with AI.
Fantastic. So this is a love story, but there are a couple of actors, right? So there's artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning. What are all these pieces? How can you explain those?
Yeah, it's obviously artificial intelligence is a very broad area. And as I mentioned before, in the artificial intelligence, you have machine learning. It's obviously I'm not an engineer, an expert in the field, but it's like a way that a machine try to replicate the intelligence of human that is not completely true. And deep learning, it's a subgroup of machine learning where you use a neural network. And in this subgroup, you have large language models. So it's very, you can find on Google a lot of different definition of artificial intelligence. There is a very strong debate around this between philosopher, engineer, doctors. So it's very complicated to say. Many philosophers say artificial intelligence is a machine and is not intelligent.
All right. So this is very philosophical. So let's get a bit more concrete. So you're an expert in resuscitation and cardiac arrest. So where is AI already showing up in cardiac arrest management today?
Yeah, we recently published a scoping review exactly to have a broader picture, like helicopter view, about the research in the last decade. And unfortunately, I can say many of the studies are retrospective. So many researchers use AI to analyze data. We have less than 50 studies that look into the future, like a prospective study. For example, there is a very nice study published in last year on Nature Medicine, randomized controlled trial, a patient arriving in the hospital, ECG standard of care versus ECG analysis by a super AI to demonstrate if this super AI is able to improve the performance of a cardiologist. And Yes, in the cardiac arrest, we had some trial in the dispatch center. At that time, it was around 2018, 2019. Machine learning was not so cool like today, and the data was neutral, so no difference between AI and humans. But at that time, the study was very nice because compared the recognition of cardiac arrest through telephone call. And many of the operator didn't trust the suggest of AI. So we need to try to be more open mind and accept sometimes the suggestion of AI, because obviously it's not better than humans, but it's like a co-pilot, so it can help us, but needs supervision of humans, because we are not completely there. We are not completely there in a recognition of cardiac arrest. Definitely, we are not completely there to give us some very strong advice like humans. But it's good help for humans, I can say. I can tell you.
And is this AI co-pilot, so to say, particularly helpful in the out-of-hospital situation for helpers who arrive at the scene, also for medical doctors within the hospital?
At the moment, we don't have a study that demonstrated that this is very useful in out-of-hospital. As I mentioned before, we have a lot of retrospective data, so not in real time, not yet there. We have a lot of data and we have a lot of research, very interesting in post-resuscitation care. So in our field, in hospital, we have a lot of analysis, as you know, in EEG, in CT scan. Last year, for example, the Nobel Prize was assigned to a physics that invented the convolutional neural network, that is the AI in the background used for CT scan, MRI. So definitely in our field, in the intersection between neurologists and intensivists, in the post-resuscitation care, this will be absolutely a very good help.
Right. So we're talking mainly about neuroprognostication, about setting the correct prognosis and how AI can be really helpful there. So where are we standing there at the moment? Are there any practical advances already?
Again, a lot of retrospective study that demonstrate a very good area under the curve, around 0.96. So not too bad. I see AI, like you are an expert on AEG. So it's like your co-pilot that you know that there are a lot of AI tool in the background now, in the CT scan, in EEG software. So it's like a good super co-pilot that can help you. The AI is very skilled, for example, in CT scan. You know, they have a lot of data. The radiologist last year in the Stanford report, FDA approved something around 250 FDA approved tools with a big background in AI in the field of a radiologist, because they manage a lot of data. And definitely in the CT scan, in MRI, this probably will be not replace a radiologist, my friend, a radiologist, but help a lot to have close to me some help in decision making.
Right. So for neuroprognostication, we frequently also use MRI scans and DWI abnormalities following cardiac arrest. But I have the feeling that there is not a clear-cut cutoff. What is a DWI abnormality associated with a poor prognosis, and where is the prognosis sort of unclear? So would AI help in this regard to give us some sort of a quantitative measure of abnormalities that we see on imaging?
You know, it's neuroprognostication is very challenging for humans, you know, because it's also related to culture. So I work in the UK, so I felt the difference between the UK neuroprognostication, the UK in Italy. I know how could be different. The prophecy, we know that. So the behavior of human could be different country by country. I'm a little bit scared to completely leave neuroprognostication to a machine. because seems like there was a very old Star Trek episode where in this episode, Amish, they stop the war in the real world, and they have something like a simulation war, and the machine decide who die in this episode. So it seems to me that there is a lot of discussion around the use of AI in ethics and in prognostication. So again, very good tool. Absolutely happy to work with him or her. But I feel always, I have a mixed feeling to completely trust now in 2025 the technology. Also because, as you know, many of this technology is led now by private company. So if you remember Fight Club, everything happened in the Fight Club, remain in the Fight Club. In the area of AI, the first rule is everything you put in AI tool, commercial AI tool, your content is always shared with third party. So it's challenging. Probably we need to invest in public resources and public space for the data of our patient. I'm very scared about to share my data and the data of my patient in AI space.
Absolutely. So for the model development, obviously this will need a lot of data, and there are some ethical concerns regarding that. But also, as you mentioned, cultural aspects. So if a model is, for example, developed in South America, it cannot readily be translated to Asia if there are different sort of approaches to neuroprognostication or to the ethical side of neuroprognostication. So how can this be resolved?
Yeah. This is a very big bias, because if you ask to, for example, we did several times this joke with ChatGPT. If you ask to ChatGPT to create an image of a child, he reproduces always a white, blonde child because the data come from, I can say, Caucasian data. So this is a very big problem in terms of diversity and quality and inclusion. Yes, because if you think, many of the data come from probably US, and also in terms of languages, many, if you use as a translator, definitely it's very skilled in US and UK English. So we need to use local data. Yes, like for microbiology, you know, for antibiotics, you need to have your local analysis of your antibiogram. So the risk to use AI that come from Taipei, like that study, obviously in that study they correctly wrote, this is one study in one hospital based on our ACG. If you think about your hospital, if you create your AI environment based on your data, your CT scan, your ESG, could be potentially biased by some difference in the population. So the data, the AI company, the private company want our data because obviously they have enough data that demonstrate the diversity of different country. And this is a limitation.
And this will need to come from the public and academic sector then to develop these models. But also, I'm sure that we will need to have the ability to actually access this data, because otherwise we'll leave this all to private companies which access data at sort of unclear measures. So I think we need to have some measures in place for academia to really work with health-related data, don't we?
Yeah, in some university, I have a dear friend of mine from Oslo, they have a closed environment where the university can put the data, analyze the data. So the machine learning, the large language model come from ChatGPT or Gemini or whatever, but the data remain in the university. So you can use the model, but the data that you put in the space will not train the model. And the other things that is good for, sometimes we believe that Europe is very old. We have an European AI Act that is a very good starting point. I hope that this not limitate our research like GDPR, with the respect with the GDPR. But for example, it's not a jungle in US and China, but it's closer jungle. So we have some regulation in Europe. And this will be a good advantages for us. There is a European project to have a factory in Europe to delivery to a big data center. We have, for example, here in Bologna, we have a Tecnopolo, a very big data center. So I dream to have a public space in our university where you can put the data, use the machine learning process, use the tools with all the respect of the data. I don't know if you read in UK, I don't know how, they use all the data available from NHS to train a model, and we'll see what happened. You know, they anonymize the data from all the patients from UK to train a super brother and sister model in UK. We'll see what happened.
These are exciting developments, right?
Yeah.
Now, let's move back to EEG, because that is sort of a technique that's very close to my heart. Now, we have clear-cut parameters for judging EEG regarding neuroprognosis. We can say, well, this EEG is associated with poor or a good prognosis, but that's just visual analysis. So do you think that machine learning approaches would help us uncover something that lies behind or beneath what we can actually see with the naked eye? Because there's so much data that's probably maybe lost looking at connectivity or other things that we just can't analyze visually, really.
Yeah, probably machine learning AI can help us to bring and combine all the data. Probably in your hospital, like in my hospital, you have a tool for blood examination, another software for EEG, another software for CT scan. And you as a human need to combine all these multimodal analysis in terms of neuroprognostication. Could be potentially useful to bring all this data together in one environment and help us to, for example, analyze more in-depth MRI or a sequence of MRI. Because definitely in radiologists, there are a lot of papers that demonstrate that AI are very, very effective in analysis of a CT scan and MRI. And if you can combine this with some physical analysis or, for example, there is some research about the use of video, analyze the visual, or I don't want to say that you can do a neurological assessment of a patient through AI, but you can combine the data. And at the end of the process, you as a neurologist and me like intensivist, we double check if is in line with prognostication or not. The final decision will be always on us. There is a lot of discussion about who is responsible for this in terms of legal aspect and ethical aspect. Definitely the end user will be us, and we need to take a responsibility base. So you look into the EEG, or I look into the monitor, the data come from a machine. It's not a Terminator style machine. But we need to take a responsibility on that, definitely, at the end of the process.
Right. So what you're dreaming about, so to say, is that in a couple of years, maybe 10, 20 years, we'll have powerful AI that will merge a lot of different multimodal, high-dimensional results of evaluations and give us some quantitative insights to support our decision-making, right? But the final decision will still be with the doctor, right?
Yeah. My vision is that we can work together as a team, and one of the member of the team will be AI with his role, her role, whatever we want to call her or him, but definitely is a teamwork.
So you're not afraid of losing your job at the moment, are you?
No, definitely. And I'm not afraid also that you don't lose your job, but definitely this will be a teamwork, because we fail in diagnosis, we fail in prognostication, and definitely AI will fail time to time.
So what happens if an AI fails? Who's responsible then? Is the programmer responsible, or the hospital, or a doctor?
A doctor. It's a matter of you use a technology, but I think the responsibility at the end of the process, it's the end user saw the doctor in charge for the patient. So in the respect of that patient, you are in charge for the final decision.
So let's continue dreaming a bit. So which timeline are we talking about? Are we talking about months or years or decades regarding this? What do you think?
We published a very strange article exactly asking to a couple of AI about how they will see the future in the next 10 years. So we ask in relation to the chain of survival, how many years needs to have something in recognition, how many years need to improve early CPR and early AED, and how many years need to improve post-resuscitation care. The average is between 5 and 10 years. And we also ask, and is not yet published, to humans, and they are more pessimistic than AI. But honestly, if you look into the market in the last 12 months, everything improved very, very fast, but without any control. So it's, again, it's a mixed feeling. We see what happened in the future. I think 5 and 10 years, it's a real time window for us.
All right. So to wrap up, you are quite optimistic, but also a bit cautious about safeguards. So what is your overall take about, well, how do you think is AI going to support us? And is it actually going to improve neurocritical care in the end?
Yes. Basically, also can help us in research. For example, in this scoping review, at the end of the process, we screen horrible number of article, and we remain with 197 article to extract data from this article. And we try to extract data with AI, and we also, as a double check, we analyze the data extraction from this article, from this PDF, by humans. Definitely AI work very well. So for research, for scoping review, systematic review, for example, there are a lot of research, a lot of company they are working on facilitate the researcher. But for example, if you have a PICO, the last treatment recommendation, from my point of view, remain at our level. So at the end of the process, the evidence-based medicine should be remain on our end, helped by AI. And this will help in the future, definitely, to not lose hours of screening article for a scoping review or systematic review, for example.
Lovely. That would make research much more efficient. Thank you so much, Professor Semeraro, for talking to us today and for your vision of the future with AI in cardiac arrest and neuroprognostication. Thank you. Have a good day.
Have a good day.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.